Auspiciousness. So I'd like to invite Jennifer today to share a few words to bless our gathering. Why not?
Hare Krishna to all of you. I wish for us all that we can be open with our quests and can be curious also for what lies in every answer and then again in every exploration behind that. And that it will nourish us, and also in the sharing in our breakout rooms, that this will nourish us and inspire us to continue digging deeper into the quests we have and again explorations. That's my
Hare
wish.
Krishna. Thank you. Thanks so much. Beautiful words. So may you all be blessed. May you all be welcome. And here we are, another week for satsang or ishtagosti, quest and exploration, however you may like to call it. It goes beyond branding, and it's all about, as Jennifer just said, genuine curious exploration and trying to nourish each other on the journey of ongoing exploration. After all, here we are all dealing with the infinite. So, Sivatansi Ananta, Ananta Katara Sasya, we'll say Uddhav, to experience a relish in terms of Ananta Kata, trying to say something about the infinite. It sounds kind of a contradiction, right? Let's put words to the infinite. And that's why even Anantashesh, right, the form of the absolute in our tradition, here you have Anantashesh, which is God trying, whose main duty is glorify God in another form, right? And it's Anantashesh continues to try to say as much as he can in praise of Bhagawan, and he never finds dead end rooftop. He always finds there's always something else to be said. So if Anantashesh, God himself, is unable to exhaust his own glory, so to speak, of us. But nonetheless, here we are, with trying to do the best we can, showing up every single week. So welcome. And as usual, you are more than invited. If you have any topic, question, exploration, you can raise your digital hand, as some of you have done. You're more than invited to activate your video, those who can, so we can have as much of a radically personal exchange as possible. And we have a few digital raised hands, so we'll start there. One is from whether Hari Vyasadeva or Prem, or both. I don't know. We can only put one digital hand raised in Zoom, not two. So we'll discover in a few moments whose hand is that. So welcome both, and you can unmute yourself.
Thank you, Maharaj. My pranam to you and to everybody present. I hope everybody's doing really well. So, in order to honor the passing of Coleman Barks earlier this week, I wanted to ask whether it's possible for you to share a few words on Rumi, his role in your life, and something that we all could learn from his teachings, perhaps.
Okay. Took me by surprise with that one. But yeah, thank you so much. Let me share also some poem since we are. So of course, for those who don't know, there was a few days ago someone called Coleman Barks passed. So Coleman Barks has been one of, if not the most well-known translator of Rumi in the West, very similar to Daniel Ladinsky's known for rendering the poetry of Hafiz to Western audiences, mainly in English. So their poetry, both of them, is not, let's say, a literal translation, but what we may call in our tradition sometimes is called like a Bhava Anubad or some type of rendering according to emotion, right? Like conveying of the essence of the poem in this case, not by literally translating it from the original Persian into English, but conveying the mood. In Sanskrit, also there is this artha versus bhava when addressing a text, right? Artha means the meaning of the text, the purport, translation to the meaning of the verse, or bhava, no? The mood that the verse conveys. So sometimes that may take not a literal translation, but something that may sound more like an elaboration of on the original to reach the point of conveying the intentionality behind the words. So what both Daniel Ladinsky did with Das, with Hafiz, and Coleman Barks did with Rumi is more in this bhava-nubad line, so to say, conveying of the intention through evoking with his their own words what the author tried to say. And this is, there are mixed feelings in some audiences about this. Some people may appreciate that more, some people may think that's not actually Rumi, that's not what Rumi said in the original. It's your own poem, it's your own superimposition on the original. So there are divided up opinions, especially among Persian scholars in this case, who will prefer more traditional, so to say, loyal rendering. Not all of them, but some of them. I'm totally fine with what both Coleman and Daniel are doing and continue to do. And in fact, for me, it's very, very important to have both. I mean, I have nothing against a literal translation of any text. And we are about to start in a few days a study on the Srimad Bhagavatam and also. And I remember, and the other day, someone asked, like, okay, which translation are we going to use? Are we going to use any specific translation? My reply was no. Because it will depend which verse we are going to, and there are different translations. And again, some will be more literal, some will be more conveying the mood. And we may resort to both, to some of them more in one case or the other. So anyhow, in terms of Coleman Barks, he passed a few days ago. I came to know about it 2 days after he passed. And as I made a short post the other day, I think 3 days ago or something, 2 days ago, I was actually about to have a call with him. We were already in the, I actually Daniel Ladinsky gave me a contact because I asked him, Daniel, do you know how to contact Coleman Barks? Because Coleman Barks and Daniel are friends. So he gave me a contact with from some relatives. So I contacted the relative, and she told me, yeah, he's slowing down. He's in his 90s, but we'll try to organize a call. Even if probably was going not going maybe to be a podcast per se, but at least a call. And again, I'm not just, oh, I want to have everyone in my podcast. If he cannot come to a podcast, then I don't want to talk to the person. It's just whatever. It's available. That's great. So we were going to do that, and when I asked this relative of Coleman about that, she told me she has been not feeling well, so try again in 2 weeks. So I waited 2 weeks, and then I came to know about his passing, right? So regarding the invitation by Hari Vyasadeva to share a few words in relationship to Rumi's particular, I like maybe I can share one since we have been talking about Coleman Barks as well. I have a few poems here. There's one particular book that I read from him called The Essential Rumi, very recommended. So there are many here. I've compiled them, I put them in a separate file. I have a whole file with poet compilations of my favorite poems from different authors. So this is from Coleman Barks and Rumi. Because I also have Rumi according to Daniel Ladinsky, which is also beautiful in its own way. But here's The Essential Rumi by Coleman Barks. So I don't know. There is one called, the first one that appears called Where Everything is Music. And it says, don't worry about saving these songs. And if one of our instruments breaks, it doesn't matter. We have fallen into the place where everything is music. So that's the poem. And again, I cannot avoid making my On Gaudiya Vaishnava parallels with Brahma Samhita, saying the land where every step is dance, every word is song. And Jiva Goswami commenting, if every word is song, what must be what they actually start to sing? And here Rumi is saying, basically, we have fallen into the place where everything is music, right? Krishna's flute is the orchestrator of every movement. There are a few more. I'll read a few more and then a few words on Rumi, but already these are a few words on Rumi, by Rumi. One called a mouse and a frog. It's some of them are not the whole poem, just excerpts that I selected. This says, do you pay regular visits to yourself? Don't argue or answer rationally. Let us die and in dying and dying reply. So of course, dying doesn't, again, we are talking about poetry, so don't try to read poetry literally. So this is not a poem about kill yourself. It's about dying to what you need to die. And through that death, you can actually reply and you can actually pay a visit to yourself. A regular visit to yourself implies every time you pay a visit, there is something to die to and to be born to. This is nice, called the Sunrise Ruby. Say, submit to a daily practice. Your loyalty to that is a ring on the door. Keep knocking, and the joy inside will eventually open a window and look out to see who is there. Another beautiful way of speaking about our daily showing up in sadhana, basically, right? Even if the experience is not otherworldly, even if we are not on our best day, try to show up, right? Try to understand that in the showing up, there's already a fruit there, right? Like the other day, also, when I made that post about Rumi, Ashram Maharaj published his own favorite poem, which is connected to that. I can maybe try to find it then. Share it with you because that's the last one, I promise. Well, I can also break my promise. It's a well-known one and it's very beautiful and very applicable to, especially in the context of Gaudiya Vaishnavism and especially in the context of those who sometimes feel a little bit traumatized or stigmatized, or I'm chanting and I'm not feeling anything and I'm doing things wrong and what's wrong with me. So here is the poem called Love Dogs. One night, a man was crying, Allah, Allah, calling God. His lips grew sweet with the praising until a cynic said, so, I have heard you calling out, but have you ever gotten any response? The man had no answer to that. He quit praying and fell into a confused sleep. He dreamed he saw Khidri, the guide of souls, in a thick green foliage, asking, why did you stop praising? Because I've never heard anything back. This, and the reply then is, this longing you express is the return message. The grief you cry out from draws you toward union. Your pure sadness that wants help is the secret cup. Listen to the moan of a dog for its master. That whining is the connection. There are love dogs no one knows the names of. Give your life to be one of them. To be a love dog. The different poems that all of them, I will say, are very encouraging, right? Very hopeful, hope-giving. And invite us to appreciate what we already have, where we already are. Especially when we feel I'm nowhere, I'm feeling nothing, there's no progress, and inviting us to change our angle of vision enough to appreciate and rediscover the gifts that keep coming. So, about Rumi, of course, there is so much to say. I don't want to take so much time. I remember we did a Swami Reacts, like a review on the book. The 40 Rules of Love, which somehow is connected to Rumi quite closely. It's a very interesting novel about, especially revolving around the relationship between Rumi and Shams of Tabriz, who was his, who will say his teacher, but also we could say his companion, his friend. So, and Rumi was someone who originally was known as someone with very well, good reputation, like an impeccable scholar in town, very renowned, good position, good fame, good knowledge, a genius. Everyone loved him. Until he became a mystic, so to say. Then he started getting into trouble. So this particular novel, which is not to represent a fully accurate historical account of Rumi's life, but it gives a very interesting, conveys the very gist of his transformation, right? He was a scholar of religion, of Islam. He was not a poet, he was a scholar, a teacher. Oh, like a guru in a more formal way, let's put it that way. You have like mystical poet gurus, fall divinely intoxicated in love, and some others who are more like official gurus, so to say, official teachers. Like, well, sometimes the difference between words will be a prophet versus a priest, right? The priest is more like keeping the statu quo. Conducting certain religious rituals, keeping the social religious order in place, and that there's nothing bad with that. And then you have the prophets or the mystics who basically are necessary to disrupt a statu quo and I mean honor the order, but also show that at certain point every order becomes suffocating, and every order that was beneficial at one point needs to be disrupted to bring forth a new order. So we will say that Rumi in the beginning phase of his life was more of this order person, a teacher, scholar, appreciated at home, town, family. And Shams of Tabriz was eventually his teacher and his life friend. And when they met together, Rumi basically underwent a dramatic transformation and became. He entered the tavern with Shams of Tabriz to drink from the cup without end, as they will use that imaginary in mystical, in Sufism and other traditions as well, our tradition as well. So from that moment on, Rumi eventually became, yeah, become fell in love with the divine in a passionate way, became a poet. Through him, it is said that the dervish, the circle or Sufi dance began, and especially that in connection with the moments that Shams of Tabriz passed from this world, because after Shams passed or disappeared from his company, there are different versions about it, but Rumi entered into the madness of divine separation, and basically, actually, that's when he became more officially a poet, interestingly. What he was thrown into that ocean of separation from his beloved friend. The only way he could relate to reality was through poetry, very interestingly. So I've recently seen some Gaudiya Vaishnavas, at least one in particular, someone brought that to my attention that shared a few months ago, and it's okay, different views. But some criticism toward Rumi in the sense of, okay, Rumi, I've seen the Buddha speaking about Rumi, but his way of speaking looks more impersonal than personal, and he speaks a lot about merging and becoming one. And of course, there are different opinions. Some people will say yes, and other people will say, even if that will be the case, that can be worthy of appreciation and inspiration. And also, I will say there are many ways in which all this poetry by Rumi can be read. The merging sections, so to say, the oneness sections. I mean, there is lots of language in Bhakti, in our tradition, Bhakti tradition, that speaks a lot about merging and oneness, which is not the oneness and merging of it all becomes Brahman, so to say. But it's emerging in love. The two of us become one. Of course, we have our word tadatmya. No? This sangha is named tadatmya, and tadatmya means basically that means oneness. Jiva Goswami uses tadatmya with the famous example when you put an iron bar in fire, and the iron bar acquires all the properties of the fire if put enough time in the fire, though it still is an iron bar, but it becomes fire-like, fired up. So it's a form of oneness, but still each one retained their own individuality, so to say. In fact, interestingly, his Spritisandarbha Jiva Goswami also uses the term Sayujya, which generally is quite exclusively used for Brahma Sayujya or the merging into impersonal Brahman. But Jiva Goswami doesn't use Sayujya in Spritisandarbha for that. He uses Sayujya in Spritisandarbha to speak about Priti. And Priti is another name for Prem, right? For the goal of life for us Gaudiya Vaishnavas. And he will speak about that unity or communion, if we want to resort to a more Christian-like term, communion, common union, as Sayujya, which means merging. Again, merging doesn't necessarily, there are forms of merging. And you can merge with someone in deep connection, deep empathy, deep love. Doesn't mean your individual existence has been annihilated or something like that. It's just a profound state of dynamic oneness, of dynamic commonality, in which both of us retain our individual existence, and we can thus experience that state and relish it from our own unique vantage point. But at the same time, it feels that we are sharing something so much in common. So all these barriers and walls that many times we create of separateness become dissolved. Imagine all the walls of separateness that you now hold into your life become dissolved. How we will experience one another. It's difficult even to put into words, but it will be a type of oneness. And again, there are different types of oneness, but every mystical tradition brings a type of oneness, brings a type of Advaita. It's not just Advaita Vedanta and Shankaracharya. All the Vaishnava Sampradayas are Advaita. Vishishta Advaita, Dvaita Advaita, Shuddha Advaita. Even Madhvacharya's Dvaita has its own expression of non-duality, Advaita. Veda Veda, our tradition. So anyhow, all this to say that when we encounter some of those poems by Rumi, of course, someone with a Advaita Vedantin disposition will read them in a certain way, but we could always read them in terms of loving union. Because he speaks a lot about God, about love, about relationship, about passionate interaction, even about self-love. So we can make a strong case to support it. Yeah, it's not necessarily about an absolute impersonal merging, so to say. And even if someone will say, well, I think it's about impersonal merging, okay, still you can appreciate that. It's a valid goal. It may not be our cup of tea, but that's mentioned in scripture. That's allowed in eternity, right? That's a big proof to our non-sectarianism, right? If something is possible forever, something is plausible in eternity, how can I call that bad or even inferior? It's an eternity, it's in a non-dual realm. How can we create hierarchies of better, worse in non-dual eternity? I may say, yeah, I don't have some scars for that cup of tea in eternity. I'm inclined toward this particular Vaishnav cup of tea. There are many Vaishnavs cup of tea. And inside Gaudiya Vaishnavism, there is a whole array of different cups of tea and different flavors of tea. At the end, each one of us will be having its own tea bag that is unique and irrepeatable, ultimately, right? So yeah, I personally really like Rumi, though I must admit, I mean, when I read this the essential Rumi, I really like, but some of the poems I really use very shocking language, especially one. I remember a few weeks ago we recorded a podcast with Gauravani, and we were talking about Rumi. Because when I met him in Germany some months ago, he was reading Rumi, and I like, oh, I'm just reading this book, and it was a book containing poems by Rumi. So anyhow, we started to ruminate right? Together. Right. And we both, he at one point said that, yeah, but there are some poems that are quite strong. And I say one poem in particular, right? I say, yeah, that one poem. So he uses extreme, sometimes like sexual imagery and ways that are shocking, but also with a purpose, like with the purpose of shocking the reader, right? Like of taking you out of your usual way of seeing reality. And that's like a means to a message that he tries to convey beyond the packaging. And when you get it, you understand also well the intention of the sometimes shocking language. And to be honest, I mean, let's be honest, I think for many Gaudiya Vaishnavas, we are talking mostly here to an audience of Gaudiya Vaishnavas. I mean, our tradition is very sensual. Okay, let me say it, and this is Sannyasi saying it. Gaudiya Vaishnava is a very sensual tradition. I remember talking with Sri Vatsa Goswami from the Radharaman temple some years ago. We're talking about this, and he even used the word carnal. It's very carnal tradition, our tradition. I mean, there is a lot of depiction of intimacy and eroticism. And loving interaction in sexual imagery. But at the same time, paradoxically, there is so much stigma and repression on the sensual realm. So we, and by this, I'm not saying just become absolutely wild and do whatever you want and become a beast. I'm not saying that. But I'm saying don't forget that part, that section of our tradition, which is not just a section. And if you study again other traditions, there's a lot of that. If you go even to the Old Testament, you have the Song of Songs. That's very sensual. And again, I'm saying that if you read Rumi, there's a lot of sensuality and passionate love and romantic imaginary in connection to the divine. So I think it may be for many healthy to expose themselves to that language, to somehow rediscover how their own the Gaudiya tradition it's a lot about that, but in a properly centered sensuality, not only in terms of relating to the divine and acknowledging that Radha Krishna Lila basically entails a lot of that in a divine way, but also making peace where wherever we are at now as sadhakas in connection to our body, mind, emotions, sensuality, sexuality. There's lots of stigma, unfortunately. So I think it's important at least to normalize the conversations about around these topics, not to again to promote something, just rush into the most intimate depictions of erotic interaction of Radha and Krishna, so you are doing the high thing, because some people also rush into that to brand themselves as esoteric or advanced. That's not what I'm saying, but I'm just saying let's make peace with the sensual dimension. Let's acknowledge that's there, on from up to down, from the highest divine realm of Lila to our everyday life, and let's engage those faculties in a yukta way. Yukta. Krishna says in the Gita, yukta hara viharasya yukta chastasya karmasu. Yukta swapna bhodasya, no? Yukta. You have to be regulated balance in your eating, sleeping, whatever you do at sleeping, whatever you do when you are awake, recreation. I mean, whatever lies in between all that, whatever you do basically with your life, let it be yukta. Let it be sustainable and balanced. So, yeah, I don't want to go off topic, but I connect that with Rumi's sensuous depiction in his poetry, and sometimes, and the language of poetry is very necessary, and many times it's very sensual. And let's not forget, all of our treatises are poetry. Bhagavad Gita's poetry, Srimad Bhagavatam's poetry, all of the books of the Goswamis are poetry. So, this, I mean, our tradition is a tradition of poets, of drunken people in divine love. Of singers, of artists, of lovers of aesthetics, Our Gaudiya tradition is very aesthetic. God himself is described as sacred aesthetic rapture. Rasa. That's what rasa means. Taittiriya Upanishad, rasa vaisaha. The absolute is sacred aesthetic rapture. So our God is that. We have a theology of aesthetics. Bhakti-rasamrita Sindhu is a theology of aesthetics. So we have to be very careful in the name of following this tradition to become completely foreign and self-confiscate our own self from the richness of all that and embrace all that from a place of celebration, of a place of dedication, a place of love. So Rumi can help us among so many others. It's funny, I sometimes joke with this, right? Because some people may feel awkward, like, Maharaj, why you're recommending Rumi or praising Rumi, or sometimes you quote Richard Rohr, or you quote, I mean, I quote so many outside of the Gaudiya canon. That's not so classical, orthodox, and I'm like, okay, so then I can quote the Srimad Bhagavatam, right? Yeah, that's very Gaudiya. Okay, then we can go to 11th canto where there are 24 gurus. And there is a prostitute there. There is a little child. There is the wind. There is a deer. There is a spider. All that is legal because it's in the Bhagavatam, right? But if I quote Richard Rohr or Rumi, I'm off. Right? So you follow my point. It makes absolutely no sense. So you ultimately, we as Srila Samarsh will say we are to enter to a land of gurus. So everyone and everything somehow or another are pointing to the truth, directly or indirectly, as the Bhagavatam begins, Janmadhyasya jatan bayai tarata, anbayai tarata. Directly or indirectly, we have to pursue the truth, which means everything is pointing to the truth, whether directly or indirectly. So if I have the eye properly tuned and aligned, everything is teaching me about Krishna, whether what to do, what not to do, where to go or not to go. Indirectly or directly, that's secondary consideration. We may need both to have a properly informed approach. Like the Ishopanishad said, before learning wisdom, you have to learn ignorance. And so many similar statements, right? So, anyhow, Rumi Ki Jai, Coleman Barks Ki Jai. Thank you so much, Hari Vyasadeva, for the invitation to share a few words. And Rumi. Okay. Shall we go to breakout rooms for a few minutes where you can pour further poems and your reflections of whatever we share, Rumi, essential dimension, how to integrate more aesthetic sensibilities in our life, how to live a life aligned and balanced and realistic. Engaging, no? Embodiment in bhakti, as we had the retreat a few months ago in Davos in Switzerland, embodiment in bhakti. So we'll go a few minutes to the breakout rooms, more than invited to share in groups, smaller groups, newer dynamics, and see you soon back for the next sharings together. So we'll continue. We'll continue with our ongoing conversation, inviting next Rasangi from California, since we also have Rasangi for UK from UK
She's there
to
today. Good.
unmute yourself, Rasangi. Welcome.
Maharaj, dandavat pranams to you. I have my voice again, so I can ask a question. And I just wanted to start with an appreciation. And those of us that are reading and studying deeply evolution and divine love are feeling so enriched and going the questions and the contemplations, the paradigm shifts, and we're just finding so many answers and so much guidance and awe. So thank you so much for the way you've put it together. We're hoping we can finish this before the next book comes out. That's all. Want to finish this one, really complete it and imbibe it before the next one comes out.
Probably if you do the proper study of the book, Evolution, Divine Love, you will realize that you can never finish it. So
Oh.
it's totally fine. The very topic is about how everything is unfinishable.
Oh,
But yeah,
forever.
if you are concerned about my next book being published very soon, that's not happening, so no problem.
Okay, we want it to happen though. We want it to happen also though.
Yeah.
Anyway, I was thinking about something you said before. What an introduction to this gathering. You kind of shook us all up. You know, that was so beautiful what you just said about Rumi and the way it is and the sensuality, which we know is existing. And it's so much a part of our tradition, and yet the rigidity and the shut downness, the denial of those parts of us is so pronounced and prominent. It's like dragging the divine into the mundane. That makes things mundane. That's mundanity, isn't it? When we take the beautiful divine nature and mystical side, and we make it into the mud. We bring it down into very mundane thinking. Anyway, the other thing is, like, Gaur Purnima is coming. I haven't been sure where I stand with any of our tradition, because there's been so much rejecting and accepting and exploring and being honest about everything. But I'm finding attraction. I'm finding joy and relish in hearing about these pastimes. And I'm just, yeah, I'm relieved, and I want to say thank you. You know what I mean? That
I hope so.
even in spite of all of the did not reject, I don't want any of it. Oh my God, I feel so duped and betrayed, and I don't know what to trust anymore. I'm finding that thread that I accepted so long ago, but in a more authentic and honest way. So thank you for that. And my question is, from the paradigm shifts in this first chapter, true love has no opposite. Genuine love doesn't devolve into unlove. It only deepens. There is no dichotomy where love turns into its opposite. Instead, love continues to grow in intensity and depth, both in quantity and quality. So my question about that is, since we are now not thinking of us here as different from there, it is a continuum. It is a expansion. Like, if we don't meet God here, we're not going to meet him there. Is my looking and seeing unlove out there my own perversion of vision? Is it have to do with my own vision? And because if it's all coming from love, right? Krishna's love overflowing is everything, everywhere. Even if it looks not like love, it is love. And the way I'm seeing it as unlove is because of the, what, you know, the wood, the stick in my eye or whatever, my own incorrect vision. Do you understand what I mean? I know it sounds crazy, but I've been thinking about this for weeks. I'm trying to understand my own vision here, how to view my world in a way that's more aligned with unconditional love, and not as us and them and separate and enemy and friend. Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Okay, so there was a lot there. Where to begin? I think you, some weeks ago, you referred to that section of the book on True Love Has No Opposite. So it seems that that section is especially impactful for you, which I'm happy because I think it's an important point. To understand the nature of love, the nature of bhakti, ahaituki aprathihata, Sivatam will say, bhakti has no cause. No, because sometimes if something causes something else, that cause is seen as superior. But talking about bhakti, we're talking about the highest thing, so it's its own cause. Ahaituki, no hetu, no cause, and aprathihata. And it's not pointing to something else beyond itself. So bhakti is not coming from something else that gives birth to bhakti. Bhakti is not going to anything else that is superior to bhakti as the goal of bhakti. Right? So haituki aprathihata, haituki, bhakti is its own cause, aprathihata, bhakti is unbroken or bhakti is uninterrupted, it continues to go into deeper and deeper layers of itself. So for me, saying true love has no opposite is another way of saying haituki aprathihata. Or like the Bhagavatam will say, bhaktya sanjataya bhaktya. Bhakti comes from bhakti. So there's nothing that causes bhakti except bhakti. And there's nowhere else that bhakti will go except for bhakti. So bhakti comes from bhakti and goes to further bhakti. So, in connection to your question, okay, if I'm seeing unlove, in the environment, is that my own problem? There's just love outside, and I'm just the unloving one, so to say. Not necessarily. Let's also, I mean, again, all these are very lofty ideas, and sometimes we may put all of them together in a way that is a little bit messy. So, of course, we say, and our tradition teaches, as I try to show in the book, Lokabhato Lila Kaivalyam, for example, the whole cosmic manifestation exists without beginning, but it exists as an extension of God's own love life exploding, so to say. Again, we have to resort to some poetic language. God's love, the love life erupts, explodes, and one of the results of that volcanic expression is the cosmos. Wow, good, great. Of course, again, this is not created at one point in time. Material energy has no beginning. We have no beginning. Bhagavan has no beginning and no end, right? So when we are here, in our particular case, you're okay, I'm not inside of you, I cannot say how you perceive unlovingness in the world. But let's be honest, there is unloving things. Now, it's not that some people is cruelly killing others or abusing others and say, no, that's love. That's love. I'm not seeing it as love. It's my own fault. That's love. Oh, no, that's not love. Which doesn't mean that love has stopped existing. Love always remains, holding space for everything. And even when we behave in unloving ways, walk against love, aparad means to go against love, doesn't mean that because, as I sometimes say, if I engage in aparad, let's use it in bhakti terms. Sometimes we hear this idea, if you do aparad, you lose your bhakti. Sometimes it's framed like that, which is inaccurate, because that gives the idea that aparad is more powerful than bhakti, right? If I do aparad, it destroys my bhakti. So bhakti can be destroyed by going against love. Bhakti, in one sense, is love. So love can be destroyed whenever you act against love. So your going against love is more powerful than love. That's preposterous. Right? So we will say, no, just when I go and act against love, I act against love, and I therefore disconnect myself from love. I lose sight of love, but it doesn't mean that I have destroyed love, that I'm more powerful than love in my going against love. And love is voluntary, let's not forget that. So you ultimately love is a mutual participation. So if everything will be love in every sense of the term, and I know it's tempting to say that and fall into some generic new agey one-liner, everything is love, everything is love. It's dangerous also to say that because you can do lots of stuff and then qualify that crazy stuff like, well, everything is love. Right? No. But the point again is, even when we behave in the most unloving ways, as I said before, that doesn't make love go away. That doesn't cancel love's existence. I may not be behaving lovingly, but that doesn't mean that love is not still there holding space for everything. Right? Even in the worst moment, moments of abuse, that's again an unusual conversation we've had a few times. Moments where there are terrifying, horrible things being done by humanity, we will say that Krishna's love becomes present, all the more present still. That doesn't mean that the crazy stuff done by us humans is an extension of Krishna's love. We don't want to justify abuse in that way. That will be very dangerous. So yeah, love is voluntary. So voluntary means you have to have another choice apart from love. So you can actually choose love. Because if I get to choose love and the only option to choose is love and love, those are the two options. Between love and love, you choose. I mean, so I have to have a second option apart from love, which is different enough for it to be a genuine second choice. And that second choice must be not the opposite of love, again, because there's no opposite to love, but something that is misaligned with love. So when I say love has no opposite, my point is even when we behave cruelly, horribly, lowly, whatever way you want to define it, that's not the opposite of love in the sense that there's nothing that can pay opposition to true love. True love thrives despite all. If we are willing to connect with that love, again, if we are not willing to connect with that source, with that love, we may live a very hopeless life. That's a separate conversation. But if we are willing to connect, to align, to take shelter in that higher, superior, ultimate energy, even the so-called worst moments of our life will be filled with meaning and purpose. If we are not aligned with love, even the most small detail will be an existential crisis and may want to kill myself. Just by any detail. So, and we see that, we see both. We see people finding existence unbearable, and they are not just by some particular situation which is not that unbearable, but they find it unbearable because of their lack of connection with love. That's what actually makes existence unbearable, right? It's not so much, oh, I want to kill myself because my Argentina lost the World Cup in soccer. I will kill myself. I mean, many people may think like that. But the actual problem is not that Argentina lost. The actual problem is like you are so much out of tune with love that a thing like that makes you find existence absolutely hopeless and purposeless. But when the more you bring love into the picture, the more you can navigate anything and everything, including the most complex times in your life. And again, we have testimony of that as well. So again, our perception of unlovingness may be accurate. There is unlovingness, and we need to see the unlovingness to know how to deal with that, how to bring lovingness into the unlovingness. Whether we see it in the environment or whether we see it in our own selves, my own lack, my own falling short of being as loved as I can. As I always like to say, ahimsa, right? That's one of our four regulative principles, four pillars. It's not no meat eating, it's ahimsa. Ahimsa, satyam, Sochem, tapas. Those are the four. And they are sometimes exemplified by one particular practice that kind of symbolizes the whole idea, but the idea goes beyond that particular practice. So ahimsa means to be nonviolent, but addressed in a more positive way. Ahimsa means to be as kind as you can, as compassionate as you can, not to be nonviolent. Nonviolence still defines the whole thing negatively, nonviolence. So to be loving, to be and as loving as you can, with everyone including yourself. Right? So to counteract the unlovingness through lovingness. Because sometimes, if not, if we just over stigmatize ourselves with some distorted picture, like, oh no, there's only love outside. If I see unlovingness, it's only my wicked view, and I'm such a monster seeing unlovingness. And you start to be so unloving toward yourself. Right? And now you're doing the same thing with yourself and perpetrating the cycle. So, yes, there is no opposite to real love. Love can only grow into more of what it already is. But we can be looking into another direction and miss that unfolding and act unlovingly. So we shouldn't be naive and saying everything is love, and when someone is doing some terrible thing, no, that's just pure love. No, that's not true. That's not true.
So, Maharaj.
But love is still holding. Love is omnipresent, as I always like to say. It's always there, but we can also be omniabsent to the omnipresence of love. So love is always an available option. We can always choose bhakti. We can always choose to embrace loving dedication. But we can also choose something else. Oh. Because if we wouldn't have that second choice, that love is not voluntary. And if love is not voluntary, then love is not love. It's just an imposition. Prabhupada will say, right? Krishna consciousness is not an artificial imposition. So indirectly means it has to be a choice. It's a voluntary act, the most voluntary act, the most serious decision I can take in my life. Decide to love. And it's not just saying once and I'm already in. It's an ongoing daily decision. And every relationship, every act, every moment, I'm inviting to decide, do you want to embrace love or do you want to look in another direction? Love continues its course and continues to expand and grow in depth and breadth. That's love's relentless, unstoppable pace. But we can not follow that pace and do any sorts of nonsense. I don't think we need to give many examples to show how that can be the case. So,
Can I just ask a question? One more thing. Like,
yeah.
I think it has to do with what we perceive as love here, what we've been told love is, in this world. Is it not
Well,
love?
don't speak in the plural on the whole situation. You're saying, don't say we have been told,
Well,
because not every one of us may have been told the same thing. So
oh, good.
we have to be careful about not putting everyone in the same bag.
Yeah. I mean, is love here? Love?
What's here?
Is it in this world? Is
The
there
state of
love?
California.
Is there love in this and this level?
What's this level? These are words, right? Here, this level, love, but we need to clarify what we are talking
So we need to redefine or be clear about, because I
I mean,
mean,
my whole book is that it starts defining what's love. It's there. And the definition is based on Rupa Goswami's definition, so I'm not creating my own stuff. I try too hard. So, and when you play out what's love or bhakti, basically it's an alignment of your inner self with that reality called love, and that can happen anywhere and everywhere. It's not that you need to wait to the afterlife, you need to be transported with a mothership, into a faraway galaxy. That's like a magical thinking, childish mentality. At the same time, we are surrounded by people who may not behave lovingly. So that's also there coexisting simultaneously. But again, if we are inhabiting internally love as our realm, as our choice, we can even relate to all those terrible things lovingly. So again, there's a lot of unlovingness going on. Let's begin at home, work on that, and deal with everyone else, everybody else's unlovingness in the most loving way possible. Doesn't mean we will change the world, but we can start changing our world gradually.
And without judgment. I like what Bhakti Ras said, how it aligns with truth and beauty. Truth and beauty can be our North Stars, perhaps. Truth and beauty, truth and beauty.
I mean,
And love.
truth must be beautiful. If not, it's not truth at all, right?
Thank you so much.
Satyam Shivam Sundaram, it's said in Sanskrit. In Christianity, I think they have the similar thing. The truth, the how is the truth, the good and the beautiful, or the truth, the holy and the beautiful? Sanskrit, they say Satyam Shivam Sundaram. The auspicious Shivam and Sundaram. Beautiful. The truth, auspiciousness, beauty. Another way of speaking about, yeah. And the Bhagavatam, what's the main first verse of the Bhagavatam? We are all into our trailer before we start our official study. First verse concludes saying Satyam Param Dimahi. So the whole treatise is about Satyam Param Dimahi. Let's all, Dimahi is in collective tense, it's plural. So let's all together absorb our faculties in Satyam Param, in the supreme truth. Again, supreme truth has to culminate in beauty. Sometimes we may have truth of half truth, which are worse than a lie. But real truth, Satyam, in its ultimate form, Param, must be Sundaram, must converge in beauty. No wonder the Bhagavatam says Satyam Param Dimahi, and the zenith of the Bhagavatam is Braja Lila and a realm of beauty and love. So, yeah. Without stopping seeing catastrophe and tragedy and loss and abuse, I mean, those things happen, at least on certain realms of existence. But and we are called to deal with all of them as truthfully, as beautifully, as lovingly as we can. Not just condemn them or say, oh, that's their karma. This is so falling. I have nothing to do with that. I'm just going to Golok. I don't care for this stuff. It's getting on my way. No, you need to navigate through all that in the proper spirit, and that will propel us more to our desired attainment, so to say, right? Again, it's here or nowhere at all. So if I want to be in that realm of spiritual love called Golok Vrindavan, just to give an example, I must try to embody the spirit of that realm as much as I can here and now. Jam jam bhapishmaram baram tejanti antik kalivaram. Bhagavad Gita 8:6. You are transferring to your next lifetime to a place according to your current state of existence here and now. That's common sense, right? But common sense is not the most common of our senses generally. Many times it's uncommon sense. So we will call it uncommon sense, uncommon common sense. So the way I'm living my day today, February 28th, is a microcosm of the macrocosm of my eternal existence. How do I want to inhabit eternity? Well, depending how you are showing up today. That's determining you are speaking about your eternal ideals about in the way in which you are acting today. Not to make you feel bad or neurotic about it, just to make some coherent continuum and connection. Because it's not that I live a certain life. And in the moment of death, I'm hoping against hope to be transferred to a world that is diametrically opposed to how I live my life today. Really? If you so badly want to go there, whatever is there, and I'm pointing somewhere on purpose, if you want so badly to go there, why you don't start to live like that here now? That's basically how it works. And when we start to live like that here now, there we are. We already arrived. And we just keep arriving. There's always a further arrival. Vrindavan's state of consciousness. Okay, Rasangi, thank you. We'll skip this breakout room since there are a few more raised hands, so we can honor each one of those. Let me see who is the next one. Swetadweep Radhika from Ireland. Can unmute yourself. Welcome.
Pranam Maharaj, I was laughing when you said your day-to-day microcosm is like I
Today is a
know.
little messy for you.
Before you even completed the sentence, I was like, I hope not.
It's a
And I
way of
hope so.
saying, again, we all have days and days, but it's a way of saying.
Yeah, every day is messy anyway, in its
Yeah.
own way.
I mean, I'm coming out from the dentist who took out one tooth of me, so I hope this is not my eternity. So
Is it better now?
I mean, the pain from there was a big infection in the tooth, so I had direct darshan of the infection where the tooth was out. There were another living entity there, basically. So now there is some slight pain, but not from the infection, but from the extraction, basically. But
Okay.
it's clearly different. So it's just hopefully a matter of a few days to get back to normal, whatever normal is.
Yeah, well, I hope you have a smooth recovery.
Thank you.
Yeah, so my question, I actually had this question since I watched your podcast with Shelyn Kendrick. You talked a little bit about like ADHD. I mean, so I was thinking that today, like, many of us have this ADHD brain, having difficulty concentrating and like, all that. And I was thinking like, but a lot of practices in our tradition, like chanting, reading even and all that, like n require a good bit of attention, and with like we read a little bit and like our heads or minds already like, going to different places and like, it somehow feels like even harder than before, like, so I'm just wondering like, with our evolving brains or whatever, that does our practice also like evolve? Because I mean, yeah, that's all.
Yeah, that's all.
Yeah, I
Okay.
mean,
Yeah.
if you understood what I'm
I think so.
asking.
I just want to confirm that that was all from your side. Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah. Well, yeah, first with ADHD or attention deficit disorder, and some other related diagnosis that somehow become more and more common in the times we are living. And no wonder, of course. But also something that I will say is that sometimes, and of course I'm not no clinician myself, so who am I to speak authoritatively on this, but I've read some stuff about sometimes there is like, how to say, a lot of misdiagnosis in this sense, or a lot of stigma in connection to that particular diagnosis. So sometimes rather than, or even with other people with sometimes called special capacities, but in the past that was being seen as something like lower, no? Or let's say, I don't know, autistic children, no? And you may say, okay, there are some may see that as something lower, right? Like something like not normal, quote unquote. But again, what's normal, right? What's normal for every person? And again, you have this all this I don't know if you have seen this series, the Telepathy Tapes. That's an interesting series where they show how many of these autistic children basically are communicating with one another around the world. And they don't know each other. They are communicating telepathically, basically. This very famous podcast series published a few hours, years ago, or 2 years ago, 1 year ago, the Telepathy Tapes. And there are cases, and they're examining the children, and they make tests, and they put cameras to see that the children are not, or they communicate with their mother, and they send the mother to the other room, and they ask the mother to think about something, and they ask the child, "What's your mother thinking about?" And the child always says the correct thing. So things like that, right? And you may say, "Oh, they're all autistic, so they are inferior, or they are whatever." No, they have special capacities. And in certain ways, they may not be as capable for some things as other people, but in other ways, they are more capable. So I think we need to, speaking in terms of radical personalism, we need to be radically personal in addressing each given case and like trying to find the uniqueness of every case and the unique adhikar, let's say, of every case. Each adhikar is. I have my limits and my capacities, my combination of all that in very unique ways. It's not like lower, higher. Like when we speak about intelligence, even, right? Sometimes people may say, okay, this person is more or less intelligent, but there are so many intelligences, right? There's not just one intelligence. Some people think intelligence means to, I don't know, to have a PhD or to have memory. But then you have emotional intelligence, and nowadays the people speak sometimes about 11 types of intelligence. So what type of intelligence we are talking about? So the same with this, right? Okay, deficit attention deficit disorder sometimes may just be, I'm talking in general, again, I'm not giving a universal diagnosis for everyone in the world, but it may be a new form of attention or a particular way in which attention happens for that person that doesn't fit in with the usual way we think of attention. So, and even if someone may say, okay, but even it's something biologically inherited by previous generations due to social media multitasking stuff, and now they're inheriting that in their genes. Even if that will be the case, which that's another conversation, still that will create its own form of attention. And I'm sure that as it may fall short of certain capacities for some, it may have its own unique features that were not present in other forms of attention. So I'm not so much like, how to say, nostalgic old school. So to say, no, all the old intelligence was the only one that worked, and all these new kids, all of you Gen Z or whatever, are all spoiled. Why you cannot read a book? Like I read for hours. You are so incapable. You can only hear an audiobook, and even that in a distracted way. I feel tempted to fall into that prejudice a few times, especially as a book writer, and I'm going with my books, and some new second generation devotees look at me with all their good face and affection. It's like, Maharaj, I love you, but I don't read books. And I'm like, I mean, what do you mean? I write books. I read books, and I write, and you don't even read books. If you have an audiobook version, I could try. I could try. And I'm like, I don't have an audiobook version. Anyhow, some of those unique dynamics. But yeah, at the same time, I will say, let's say that someone is genuinely diagnosed with attention deficit disorder. Again, to begin with, there is no need to stigmatize that to make the person feel worse or whatever. You have what you have. And I'm not saying it's worse than any other. It's just, it's what you have. Everyone has what they have. Karmically, if you want to use that terminology, you receive a certain package in terms of bodily health, even mental capacity. Some people may have super bright memories and their body health is terrible, and all these possible combinations in between. So no need to compare each other. Just to make that point, right? Because grass always seems greener on the other side of the fence. And you can never be the other person. So you bet we better are who we are. But at the same time, if we experience some difficulty with keeping attention for extended periods of times, and again, this is relative, right? Because we'll hear that in the old Vedic times, they will listen something once and they will commit that to memory, or they will stay for days without sleeping. So there are all these different standards that, by comparison to that, someone like me or from my generation is like, is the worst of the worst. So we gotta always find some, again, object of comparison that will make you feel you are in the worst possible situation. But there's no point to do that, right? So there's a point to see, okay, which are the unique features of the situation I'm in. Again, like I always say in the Bhagavatam, the 12th canto of the Bhagavatam concludes with Kali Yuga and it starts describing some of the attributes of the age and of the inhabitants of the age, which are not necessarily the most glorious in comparison to other ages, right? In Satya Yuga, they live this long. In Kali Yuga, they live this long. Way less. In Satya Yuga, they had this. In Kali. So there is some form of comparison that makes you feel quite discouraged in one point, but it's with the purpose of creating some contrast. And then the whole book concludes singing about the glories of Kali Yuga. Not like saying, okay, yeah, we may not have that, but the unique thing is this. And this makes this age actually better than all of the other ones. And again, not to fall in comparison now, oh, we are in the best age. So sorry, all of you Satya Yugis, we are from Kali Yuga. Again, it's not to go there. It's just to make the point in their own way, each one has their best possible opportunity if they want. So even if we have some attention deficit disorder, whatever that may be, again, compared to other standards, still we can do the best. Again, bhakti is not depending on having the best attention in the world. At the same time, we should make, hopefully, as much as we can, some effort to not prostitute our attention, so to say. Right? Yeah. Not to like to. Not to degrade it, not to make it more and more absent, right? If we already have a lack of attention problem or a lack of presence, because again, it's not so much about attention in a professional, technical way. Ideally, it's more about present. If I'm in front of you and we are sharing and talking, it's not so much like I'll be attentive to you. I want to be present to you. And even if my mind goes off, if I have the intentionality of presence, I'll come back. And again, that's what counts, as we were reading Rumi's poetry before. Krishna's not counting how perfectly attentive you were in your last hour of japa, but how sincerely probably you endeavored to return back to presence all the times that you got distracted. That's like the famous example with Thomas Keating, right? When he was introducing centering prayer to some Christian nuns, which centering prayer in one sense is about attention, if you want to use that word, though it will be presence. You sit in presence of the divine in silence for whatever, 20 minutes or whatever. So he introduced that to a nun, and the nuns, after the 20 minutes, he asked, well, so how did it go? And the nun was clearly frustrated, and she said, my mind went off rails like 10,000 times. And Thomas Keating very spontaneously said, oh, lovely, 10,000 times of choosing God back over and over again. So he didn't see, oh, you were distracted. He saw, oh, you have a chance of choosing God again. So he didn't thought, oh, you are not perfectly attentive. He saw, oh, if you are sincere, you have always the chance of returning back to presence. And that's what Krishna is looking for, basically. Not again, perfect performance, but sincere struggle to be present, even with all our difficulties. But again, I say, if we are sincere, part of the sincerity is I'll try to take care of my attention, whatever attention I have, try to take care of it, because you can always, how to say, worsen the condition. And it's quite easy to do so with nowadays bombarding of social media, multitasking, scrolling, and doing 10,000 things at the same time. I mean, you can really create habits of lack of presence, of fragmentation, and dividing yourself in multiple parts, in which you are doing too many things on the surface, not single one thing on the depths. So there is a choice in us to do something about it also. It's not just fatalistic, well, I have ADHD and what to do. No, there's always something we can do to reclaim our presence on some degree, again, to whatever degree we can today. It's a daily question. What can I do today to honor presence, to bring presence, to dignify that, and what not to do, no? What gets in the way of that? Because again, it may be in but one little thing, one little samskara I'm receiving, one little impression of lack of presence, absence, distraction, but then I repeat that act, eventually that multiple repetition creates a habit. And then it's more difficult to say no to the habit because it's more ingrained. And then the habit becomes my personality. Put a few habits together and you'll say, that's who I am. And many times that's not who you are at all. That's just your so-called sense of self, which is a bunch of habits, which are a bunch of samskaras. So we may need to deconstruct part of that system as much as we can. As much as we can. And Krishna says in the Gita, he acknowledges to Arjuna, yeah, it's not easy to go against your nature. And I'm not saying going against, but if I recognize I have acquired as part of my nature certain things that are clearly not good and not healthy and are avoidable, okay, what can I do to unlearn that, deconstruct that? How to bring minimalism to my life? How to do a day in the week of contact with nature, no phone whatsoever. How can I have my Sabbath, as the Jewish people will have, like one day a week of not working, not contacting technology, just presence? I'm not saying you have to do it in the same way, but again, each one has to be creative in their own ways and doing whether it's once a week, moments per day, moments per month. And sometimes we need to be intentional about it and kind of force ourselves a little bit against our lower nature that says, no, just keep scrolling for 3 more hours, please. And you know, nothing will save from that 3 hours scrolling. Better I go for a walk in nature. Better I sit with my family and we light the fire and we have a significant, meaningful conversation. Oh, but you have to wake up and you have to bring wood and put on a fire. You just can't keep scrolling. That's so easy. Yeah. But easy is never the way out. Easy is never the way out. So just to balance the whole thing, right? I think it's important. And as you say, yeah, sometimes going to your question, practices of bhakti, well, and it's not that we are changing the whole practices and the whole sampradaya, but they may be tailored to our particular conditions so we can relate to them in a relatable way, in a way that doesn't feel impossible, in a way that doesn't feel discouraging. Bhaktivinoda Thakur himself, he said in his books, okay, for most people, japa is complicated. I mean, he said that a few hundred years ago. Imagine. He was not in the era of multitasking. No? He said, for most people, sitting and chanting japa attentively is not so easy. So that's why Sankirtan is the yuga dharma. Japa is not the Yuga Dharma. If you say Yuga Dharma, the universal religion for everyone is to sit for 2 hours still without stop and chant Maha Mantra, you have thrown the Yuga Dharma out of the window. Who will embrace that? Most people will be terrified. But if you say, no, we'll be singing together, dancing, celebrating existence in a very tasteful way, okay, I see myself doing that. He will say, and the more you do that, then the more the mind becomes more attached to the name, more purified, more settled, more presence, and then japa can be a complementary reality to the reality of Sankirtan. But sometimes I see between the boats, unfortunately, japa is presented more kind of the yuga dharma in the sense that you do it and you do it in a certain amount of number. And if you do it like that, you are in. If you don't do it, you're out. Black and white. And it's like, whoa, where's that coming from? That degree of emphasis. And again, the point then is that people start to do it just to reach the number, and they don't care for presence, for attention, for anything. Just fill in the daily quota so you belong to the tribe and you are not sent into exile. So then nobody cares for what's going on in your inner life and the quality of your chanting. Just show me the number. Can you hear me? Okay, because I'm receiving some audio alert from Zoom that say my speaker is not working. Anyhow, as long as you are hearing me. So yeah, at the end of the day, the practices and the sadhana is to be tailored according to each particular case. That's my belief. That's what I think it's, and I don't think it's my own, of course, and I'm not the only one in this. But a guru or a guide, if he or she is engaging the student in some particular practice, should be according to the adhikar of the person. That's why adhikar is to be established first, where everyone is and what can we prescribe accordingly. It's like if you come to me as a doctor and I prescribe you medicine without studying your situation. You enter the room, you sit and say, okay, take Tylenol and ibuprofen 10 per day. And you're like, but I haven't even told you what's my problem, where I am. It's like, it makes no sense, right? So in the same way, we need to know where every person is, and then sadhana is to be performed accordingly, and it may need to be adjusted in time. Not only quantity, but quality and varieties, different expressions of devotion. So it's not a fixed box, right, basically. I don't know if that helps. Sweat a bit.
Yes, Maharaj, so much. Like, yeah, so much to contemplate and also like so inspiring. Yeah, thank you so much.
Okay. Thank you. So let's go to breakout rooms so everyone shares their own trauma experience. I need to bring humor, of course, right? Because we are talking about very serious stuff here. So humor is a necessary ingredient in the masala so we can process it all. Okay, we are going there to the breakout rooms for a few moments and then we will be returning. And there's one last question by Abhinandana that we'll be addressing in a few moments. Okay, so we'll go to one last question by Abhinandana, which I think was one that was waiting from last weekend. So invited to unmute yourself. Abhinandana, welcome.
Thank you, Maharaj. So I had a question about the Divine Feminine. It's more like I can when I first got to know about Krishna consciousness, about Krishna, and it was like so rapid, like I could easily there was I could easily relate, but as for with Sri Radha, I didn't feel that. So I have been trying to explore that for the past few weeks. And when I got your book, I thought the section which you wrote about Sri Radha, I thought that would be the last part to read. But I read that first, and it was really amazing. So I've just been thinking about that, and I also read in Radha Madhav Prabhu's website that a lot of things this has to do with healing our relationship with the Divine Feminine. I don't really so I just wanted to hear about that. And also another, I think I don't know if it's along the same track, but is I can very easily relate with connect or feel the connection with Mother Nature. We call her Bhumi Devi. So is she also the divine feminine, or that is
Okay. Thank you.
what does he mean?
Yeah. So a few words on the divine feminine. I think we were talking, thank you for your question, and we were talking some days ago, maybe last week, that when we talked about the divine, God, whatever word you want to use, we have to be, it's always tricky, right? Because we talked with words, and words facilitate the expression of something, but while facilitating, many times they also limit. Because we can say something about God through words, and that can be accurate, and that doesn't mean that those words fully encompass the reality of the infinite. So when we say God is masculine, because many times the patriarchal influence has been there to the point that God is seen as man, father, God, king. And I'm not denying he can be any of those things, but that's only half of the equation, right? We have the yin and the yang, right? The polarities, female polarity, male polarity, in the divine, in us. In one sense, we are a microcosm of infinite reality somehow. So we also have feminine and male dimensions, whether we are born biologically as male or female. So when we speak about the divine, God, sweet absolute, whatever terms in English, we have it easier because I can say the sweet absolute, and that's gender neutral, right? If I say that in Spanish, that's immediately masculine. So if I say the infinite in English, that's neutral. If I say that in Spanish, that goes immediately to masculine. If I will try to say that in feminine, it will sound weird. So that's that in itself speaks about the lack of articulation in certain languages and imagination about the divinity as female. But our tradition is very much, and not only our tradition, all traditions have their own, as I tried to mention briefly in that chapter of my book, whether we talk about Sophia or the divine wisdom and divine love and different words in Judaism, Islam, Christianity for the feminine principle, Shekinah, etc. And we all do not only have Radha, of course, you can speak about Sita and I mean Lakshmi and Devi and Shakti and Bhumi. And yeah, Mother Nature is an expression of the divine feminine. Like we were talking the other day, right? When Ramachandra is rescuing Sita from her being kidnapped, besides the Leela, as it could be read more literally, on a more archetypal, symbolic level, that represents the divine feminine and the divine masculine together, the integration of both polarities, the longing for that integration rather than divine masculine over there, divine feminine over there. No, there's always a longing for reunion. And the role of separation is just to create a new level of reunion. Separation never exists for separation's own sake, right? Radha Krishna Leela is full of union and separation. And our acharyas even highlight separation especially, but not because of separation's sake. It's not like the separation is so cool, let them remain separated forever. That would be like the ultimate betrayal. But because of the purpose that separation has in service to a new level of union of these two polarities. So that's all over again. And there are feminine qualities, feminine principles that we are all invited to imbibe, to integrate, you know? Receptivity, what else? I don't know. Intuition, nurturance, relationality, fluidity, creativity. All this is very feminine in nature. Embodiment, we were talking about embodiment before, holding space. So again, this doesn't necessarily have to do with being born as a woman or not, because sometimes you can be born as a woman and unfortunately be very ostracized from your feminine side and become toxically masculine. And you are cut off from relationality and embodiment and intuition and creativity, which is all there present in potential. So each one of us can be alienated from a proper integration of these polarities. So the divine feminine is a crucial way of referring to God. And many people, not only in our tradition, but in other traditions, they have felt so much the weight of an exclusive male God that they feel the need just to recur to a new language, recur to a new grammar. And again, when we and speak about God as she, so they will speak, write the whole book, and they use the word God, 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 God. But when it comes to see to use the gender words, they will say she, her. And in the beginning, it's like maybe shocking, right? Even in our tradition, it's shocking to speak about guru in terms of she or her, right? So it's all related. No? It's all related. That's why in my chapter, if you remember, in Radical Personalism, the chapter on Guru Tattva, mostly all the chapter I refer to guru as she and her. And I clarify, I know this will be shocking for the reader, but I'm doing that. So if you are shocked, then you are being mirrored back your own. What's triggering you? And there's something to solve there because why you are shocked? Sorry, my hand is raised when I move my hands. So, and again, even when we say the divine is feminine and masculine, yes, but at the same time, it transcends our own ideas of feminine and masculine. And it includes the healthiest possible expression of both that we can imagine. But it's not limited to our idea and experience of that. Because let's be honest, as much as we try to be balanced in our female and masculine sides, we may still have some way to go in terms of integrating. So if my current notion of feminine and masculine is work in progress, great, congratulations, you're a work in progress. But be careful of thinking, oh, and God is male and masculine in my own work in progress version. No. They are work in progress in terms of ever evolving, but in their own way. So yeah, God is one, God is a divine couple, God can be expressed as a trinity, God can be expressed in terms of four, as a male, as a female, as an I mean, we are dealing with the infinite here, no? Stay in wonder for a moment. Sometimes it's healthy to enter into silence and acknowledge the unknowability of that realm. We can say so much, but there's a point that still that is not enough. And yeah, we sometimes what's called the movement Krishna consciousness, and somehow they interpret Krishna consciousness as, okay, it's all about Krishna, and at the same time, their reading of Krishna is not with a healthy female side integrated. So poor Krishna, right? They make who knows which idea of Krishna in their minds. Because Krishna is really vulnerable, really feminine in so many ways, as I tried to describe in chapter on vulnerability and empowerment in Radical Personalism. He's wounded by the arrows of Cupid, he's falling at the feet of Radha, he's very submissive, very artistic, very creative, very receptive, very everything. But Krishna consciousness, this is not Krishna consciousness sometimes we and there's a place to say that. I'm not against, of course, the name, and I'm not against expression. But we take Krishna consciousness for me to become conscious of Krishna. Now, actually, Krishna consciousness is an English rendering of Krishna Chaitanya, which is the name of Mahaprabhu as a sannyasi, right? So Krishna Chaitanya means Krishna consciousness. And who embodies Krishna consciousness more than anyone? Sri Radha. So in one sense, Krishna consciousness is all about Radha. You can read it from that way. Who embodies Krishna? Who is more Krishna? Krishnamayi Devi Prokta, and so on. Famous verse describing Sri Radha. Sarva Lakshmi Mayi Sarva Sammohini Pada. Krishnamayi. No, she's Krishnamayi. Her whole being is Krishna. She's pervaded by Krishna in every thought, every action, every feeling. So she's Krishna Chaitanya. That's why there is an esoteric reason that Mahaprabhu accepted sannyas. I was given that name. As something that will help him to go deeper into his exploration of Radha Bhava, because that's the main purpose of Gaur Lila, right? And the name he was given was not only Krishna Chaitanya, it was Sri Krishna Chaitanya. So Sri is a name for Sri Radha. Sri Krishna Chaitanya. So how Sri is Chaitanya of Krishna, so to say, how Sri Radha is conscious of Krishna. Like we say Srimad Bhagavatam. The meaning of Srimad Bhagavatam is the Mada or the madness, Srimad of Sri for Bhagavan Sri Krishna. That's what the Bhagavatam is ultimately about. Srimad Bhagavatam. Sri Krishna Chaitanya. How Sri Radha is Krishna conscious. And Mahaprabhu embodies that because it's Krishna embodying Radha, being conscious of Krishna. So she's all along present there, but somehow again we read Krishna consciousness, who knows in which way, and we throw Radha out of the picture, and only Krishna remains. And the problem, if you have Krishna without Radha, how much you can call that Krishna? Right? You cannot separate the two. You cannot separate the two. If you take out Radha, that's no longer Krishna. I don't know who he is. We are talking about somewhere else. In one sense, Radha and Krishna are one. They're inseparable. Vishwanatha Chakravarti Thakur, in his Prema Samput, will say they are one soul in two bodies, interacting lovingly for the sake of Leela and relishing rasa. So yeah, Radha is very, very important. Mahaprabhu is very important. Personally, I found that very beautiful balance, and again, each one of them spoke about every one of these facets of the infinite. But Srila Prabhupada generally will speak more about Krishna. And again, I'm not criticizing that at all. He had his own reasons for that, in terms of internal affinity. Now, Srila Prabhupada himself, as you know, hopefully by now, when he was asked, "When you are no longer here, to whom which shall we go for Shiksha?" His disciples to Srila Siddhar Maharaj. And when you go to Srila Siddhar Maharaj, he also will speak about Krishna, of course. But mostly he will speak about Radha and Mahaprabhu. And Mahaprabhu in connection to Radha. But of course, again, Krishna also, because we are not talking about different people here. So just different perspectives and different degrees of emphasis, also according to affinity. So yeah, we have to somehow or other be aligned with the divine feminine, whether in terms of Radha or in terms of divine nature, sacred nature, Bhumi Devi. These are all expressions of the same principle, and no wonder when we are dysfunctional in our own dealings with our female dimension, we don't know what to do with all that. We are ostracized. We are isolated from nature. We will end up embracing very toxically patriarchal masculine ways of thinking, too much control, too much order, not much space for chaos. And feminine is chaos. But chaos is not a bad word. Chaos more like in the realm that lies beyond order, the unknown realm where creativity can take place. For you to be creative, you have to go outside of the comfort zone. You cannot be a genius artist from your sofa, from the status quo, from comfort zone. You need to go out there and explore the unknown, the realm of chaos, and dealing with that, articulating that chaos and bringing order to that, that's a new creation. So feminine has to do with all of that, and no wonder we are terrified about that. Because it requires courage to confront all that. So don't no wonder why many males mostly want to cancel and dismiss the feminine in all its expressions. They don't know what to do with it. Sometimes it's not even bad intention, it's just they are overwhelmed. They don't know how to deal with that. So they try to cancel, to silence it, to not give a place, not give a voice, whether it's in the form you cannot be guru or you cannot speak, you don't have rights, you cannot vote. I mean, study human history. You are relegated to some secondary place in the temple, in the kirtan, in a rock concert, in anywhere in society, because it's all about, I don't know what the heck to do with this feminine principle. Unconsciously, that's the, I'm terrified about all the, what it is inviting me to, because we don't have that properly integrated in ourselves. So that's why it's so important to acknowledge that, confront that, integrate that, and become whole, wholesome people. That's invitation. Not only be transcendental, but become wholesome. That means a proper balance integration of polarities. Not that in the name of transcendence, being absolutely dysfunctional as a human, I'm mistreating everyone on my way to Golok. Right? I don't care for any of you. I'm on my way to Golok. I don't have time to treat you well. I'm too transcendental right now. No. You probably need therapy. You probably have deep, unresolved childhood trauma. And you have lots of layers unintegrated, and you're just doing spiritual bypassing and using the highest noble ideals to hide, to create a mask. And that's a great disservice. So yeah, the feminine comes to reclaim itself and to invite us to, again, both to male-bodied people, female-bodied people, all of us are invited to integration of polarities. It's all balance. It's all about balance. So I hope that helps. There's, of course, there's so much more to say about this, but I don't want to take much more of your time. And I will invite you one last time to share in breakout rooms before we put our sharing to rest, if you have at least a few more minutes, so we can share in community and be feminine enough to be vulnerable and open and sharing about our thoughts and experiences and concerns regarding feminine, divine feminine, feminine principle, and the integration of this in our life, in our community, in our world. So, see you back in a few minutes. I welcome you back again. And yeah, smiling faces. So, I trust you had a nourishing time together. Thank you so much for being willing to participate always and showing up courageously every week. So, we'll put our sharing to rest today. And hopefully see you soon before next Saturday, because on Tuesday we'll be celebrating Sri Gaur Purnim, speaking about Sri Krishna Chaitanya. So of course, probably some of you will be busy with local celebrations or something, but for those who have time, willingness, we'll be connecting on this coming Tuesday at 10 in the morning EST times, which will be 4 hours earlier than this meeting, because I'm also having a Spanish meeting later, so I have to have some breathing space in between. So whomever can connect, welcome. Whomever cannot connect, still we will of course share it in the YouTube channel then. But it will be the same link, access info, on this coming Tuesday, 4 hours earlier, 10 a.m. EST. And as I briefly mentioned, many some of you already know, we are starting a weekly Srimad Bhagavatam study adventure. That will be starting not this coming Monday, but the other Monday. So this coming Monday, we'll be sharing a flyer. Maybe some of you saw it, and you will be invited to participate as well. So it will be a Monday. You have already the details, so you will have them on Monday. It's an extended way of continuing sharing together. So looking forward to that exploration. But for now, we put to rest today's meeting. Looking forward to see you soon. Thank you so much to all of you. Sri Krishna Chaitanya Mahaprabhu ki jai. Sri Harinam Prabhu ki jai. Sadhu Sangha ki jai. Gaur Priman Hari Hari Vo. Panchakalpataru Sagripa Sindhu Vyayu Chavati Dhanam Pavanepyo Vaishnavebhyo Namo Namah.